The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
It was a story that gripped America and indeed the world when hundreds of brave women came forward to tell their story as it became apparent that US gymnastics doctor Larry Nassar had sexually abused hundreds of women over decades. And Rachel Den Hollander was the first victim to publicly accuse Nassar. And I'm delighted to say she joins us this morning from America. Good morning to you, Rachel. Nice to talk to you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about you as a young child watching television, watching the Olympics, getting very excited?
Yeah, gymnastics was something that I loved. I loved what it required out of me. I loved the beauty and the determination and just that combination of mental and physical that the sport required. I didn't actually get to start till I was almost 12, so I was never destined to be anything great. But it was something I just loved to do.
So you weren't necessarily in the elite squad, as it were, but you kept going and you enjoyed gymnastics, which brought you to the attention, or at least in front of, Dr. Larry Nassar. What did you know about him before you met him?
Larry was a household name in the gymnastics community. Yeah, it's a very insular community, and everybody knew everybody. And we were, as young gymnasts, keenly aware that Larry was the doctor who treated our Olympians. And he was the doctor that helped Carrie Strug off of the mat at that 1996 gymnastics Olympics. He wrote a book on conditioning, and coming from Michigan, where Larry was a professor at Michigan State University and the medical coordinator for their gymnastics team, as well as for one of our most prominent gyms, it was a real privilege to get to see Larry. The fact that a level 5 gymnast could see the Olympic doctor was just incredible in
right.
my mind.
Right. So you were mixing with the best then, with the likes of Nassar and his reputation and his, I suppose, the results he was incurring. And you met him, obviously. Can you remember the first time you met him, Rachel?
Very clearly. Larry was a very outgoing, gregarious, caring sort of man. You know, he made you feel like he was going to take care of you. He was going to protect you. He was going to fix things up. And he was so much better in every respect than any doctor I had seen in terms of his personality and his apparent just thoroughness in evaluation and his knowledge of gymnastics. And so again, it provided me with a lot of assurance that this is the best place to be.
And what age were you when you started seeing Larry Nassar professionally?
It was just after my 15th birthday.
And the type of physical examination he undertook was really your first indication that there's something not right here. I don't want to cause you any upset, and I don't want to trigger anything, I have to say, but you've written about this, so I will ask you in terms of how much you can say regarding the nature of the exam was.
Yeah, so Larry would do very thorough evaluations, testing our muscle strength and flexibility and just how different muscles fired and just how our overall body was working. And he would do so with the way gymnastics had to work physically in mind. And so when he did my initial evaluation, he found several important things. He found certain muscles that didn't fire in the right order. He found certain muscles in my shoulders that were overly tight and that caused pressure on my lower back. And so the way he explained it to my mom was that he needed to do what he called myofascial release. And this is a legitimate medical technique that works on the outer sheath of muscle. And it helps release tension, release tightness. And so he explained that this is what he was going to do. But when he began to do sports massage and myofascial release, he would use his other hand to digitally penetrate underneath a draped towel. And at the time I saw Larry, I was aware that certain injuries could require a legitimate form of internal pelvic floor release. And so my presumption was that Larry was trained and certified in this specialized technique for pelvic floor release. What I didn't know at that time as a 15-year-old is that he had no training and no certification, and that what he was doing didn't bear any resemblance to legitimate pelvic floor technique. It was simply sexual abuse through and through.
And you're at that stage, you're 15 years old, you've placed your trust in this man, as is often the case with abusers and victims. When you left the room that day, did you think that didn't feel right? Or did you think, well, he must know what he's doing, he's a professional?
Yeah, there was a very specific thought process that I went through. My mom was actually in the room when Larry abused me every time. And I thought that she could see what was going on. And so that was part of what made me think this must be all right, because my mom's sitting right here and surely she would say something. And what I didn't know was that Larry was very skilled at hiding what he was doing from a parent's viewpoint. This was actually normal. Most of the children that were abused, their parents were in the room when it happened. And he would position himself in between the parents and their child, in between their line of sight, so the parents couldn't see what was happening. But of course, the children didn't know that. I didn't know that. So the thought process I went through was, this is clearly something he does regularly. You know, his movements were very brazen. They were very rehearsed. I knew I wasn't, this wasn't a test case. This is clearly something he does regularly. If this is something he does regularly, surely other kids have described what Larry's doing. Other Olympians have described what Larry's doing. There's no way adults in authority at Michigan State University, the university where Larry worked, or at United States Association of Gymnastics, haven't heard this technique described. If adults heard this technique described, they would surely make sure that this is legitimate medical technique. They would surely make sure that Larry is certified in pelvic floor therapy. So this must be legitimate. You know, I not only trusted Larry, I trusted the adults in authority, his coworkers and the people in authority over him, to be properly supervising him. And my trust was greatly misplaced on both counts.
And as the appointments went on, did he become braver in the sense that he decided he'd try more oftenless, if you like?
There was definitely an escalation of abuse to an extent. I don't know that I would say braver, because by the time I saw Larry, his method of abuse was already very well rehearsed. There were probably hundreds of women that came before me. So he knew exactly what he was doing. He knew what he could get away with. But there was definitely an escalation of abuse as I saw him.
Your mother was in the room, and you described how he would position himself. Is that so that his body, the bulk of his body, was hiding what he was doing to you? And was he one of those people that he would kind of be chatting away to your mother, talking away to her to distract? I mean, it sounds like he almost had an operation going on here.
Oh, he absolutely had an operation going on. And he groomed not just the children he abused, he groomed the community around them.
Right.
And that's something I think we need to grapple with more, is just what skilled manipulators abusers are. And he did manipulate my parents as well. You know, obviously, they couldn't see what was going on. And he did continue just a steady line of discussion with my mom. He would talk about my schoolwork and my homework and what my siblings were doing, and just made small talk. He invested himself in our life as a cover for what he was doing.
When you noticed at one point that he was sexually aroused physically, did you kind of want to scream there and then, or did you wait till you got home and tell somebody? What does the victim, especially one so young, do with that sight and that knowledge, that sensation?
Yeah, that was that is a response that I had to really grapple with. I knew at the time about these. Everybody says that there's fight and flight, but what I didn't know at 15 was that trauma also causes a third response in about half of survivors, and that third response is freeze. And it's when you are just so overcome with the shock of what's happening that you can't move, you can't cry out, you can't do anything. And I experienced that response at the moment that Larry escalated to a point that I just couldn't rationalize away anymore, and I knew that he had sexually assaulted me. At least part of what he had done was sexual abuse. I wasn't able to do anything at all. I couldn't cry out. I couldn't move. And then when that moment passed and we got out of the exam room, the amount of confusion at who Larry was, trying to figure out and mesh together who this person was, who he really was, with who I believed him to be, and the amount of shame that comes along with sexual abuse, that really kept me silent for about another year.
Right. I mean, 15 is a tricky age for boys and girls anyway, but to be going through what you were going through, that these constant assault, adding to it. So you had all this going on in your life and in your world. At what point then did you say, I need to talk about this because I can't take it anymore?
Yeah, I was really struggling with the effects of abuse at that point. I was struggling with understanding my own response to abuse, my own inability to cry out, how I hadn't seen the warning signs, seen the grooming. How could I have not seen this? And so I was struggling through all of that resultant trauma. And it was really my mom who came to me, and she had noticed certain things in my behavior that had gotten to the point where she thought something had to have happened with someone that she didn't know. And so she just outright asked me, has something happened that I don't know? And because she observed my behavior closely and she was able to ask those questions, it helped me be able to verbalize what had happened.
You verbalized what had happened to your mother, who was in the room while it was happening. Tell me about that conversation.
It was a very painful conversation for both of us. I am incredibly blessed that I had parents that believed me right away. I knew they would. My mom is a survivor herself. But for my mom to grapple with what was happening as she was sitting there and that she couldn't see, and she didn't even realize she couldn't see. That was very painful for her. And of course, for a survivor, when you get to the point of verbalizing your abuse, having to tell someone, that really makes it real. Putting words to it makes it real. And so for me, it was a very painful conversation as well. I'm grateful I had a safe place to have that conversation because not a lot of survivors have that, but it wasn't easy.
Tell me, if you could, Rachel, about then what you felt you should do next. Did you feel you should confront Nassar, confront the Michigan State University, the U.S. Gymnastics Organization, or did you feel shut it down, get on with our lives, and try and fix it at a local level?
Well, what I wanted to do more than anything else, and my mom as well, is we wanted to be able to stop Larry, to stop him from abusing other children. We were both confident I wasn't the first victim. His method of abuse was far too brazen and far too rehearsed for me to have been the first. And at that age, around 16, 17, I knew how pedophiles operated by that point. Mm. They didn't have just one victim. So I knew I wasn't the first, and I knew he wouldn't stop. But I also understood how culture treats abusers. I understood what a victim faces when they speak up. That instinctive cultural and community protectionism where the abuser is surrounded by members of the community and defended against allegations of abuse. I understood all of that. And because I knew I wasn't the first, what I really realized at that point in time is whoever has been speaking up has been silenced. I'm not the first. I'm not going to have been the first to speak up. And the fact that nobody has stopped him yet means that the people who are in authority are keeping the victim silent. And so what I said to my mom at that point in time as a 17-year-old is, I can't do this alone. An anonymous voice is never going to be enough. We're going to have media pressure. We've got to have some way of getting the control outside of Larry. We've got to have some way of getting control of the narrative from the two powerful organizations that are shielding him. I can't do this without media involvement. And we just didn't know what to do. How do you make something like that happen? And so we really wrestled with this. And at the end, I said, right now is not the right time. And so really what I was waiting for 16 years was just some sign in that Larry was able to be held accountable, some crack in his armor.
And with that, it's probably important to mention that you kept a lot of documents and just things that might be of use to you in the event of Larry's day of reckoning, Nassar's, I should say, day of reckoning come to light.
We did. My mom was very wise. And so we obtained all of my medical records right away. We obtained the documentation of the visits and the physician notes, all of those things, a complete medical file. And a lot of what I did for the next 16 years, and my mom included, was research to try to figure out exactly where that line was crossed, because we didn't know at that point that Larry wasn't certified in pelvic floor therapy. We didn't know what pelvic floor therapy should look like, and so we knew something was wrong, but we didn't know the extent. We didn't know how much. And so it was years of research to kind of get to the point of being able to identify even how far the abuse went and be able to explain, once I came forward, explain to investigators how I knew what he had done was abuse. And so it was quite a process that both of us went through.
You saw an article in the Indy Star that must have been some class of a light bulb moment, or certainly a torch on and ready to shine into the darkness.
Yeah, so what happened was in August of 2016, I saw an article that was published by a newspaper in Indianapolis, where USAG is headquartered. United States Association of Gymnastics is headquartered in Indianapolis. And the Indy Star newspaper had done a huge undercover investigation of how USAG was handling complaints of sexual abuse against member coaches. And they ran an article, a huge article titled Out of Balance, and it was his expose. And when I read that article, the first thing I thought was, I was right. I was right. They would have covered up for Larry, too. The thing is, with gymnastics, it wasn't a secret how prevalent sexual abuse was in the sport. An entire book had actually been written on it. There was a book written in the 1990s, called Little Girls in Pretty Boxes. And it was an expose of the abusive culture in elite gymnastics and figure skating. And it went through how pervasive sexual abuse was in that sport. So it wasn't a secret. Everybody knew, but nobody did anything. Journalists had reported on rampant sexual abuse in the sport of gymnastics before, but nobody did anything. But the difference with the Indy Star was all of a sudden people paid attention. And so when I saw this article come up, it was in my Facebook newsfeed, actually. I saw this article just a couple of hours after it published, and I realized I was right. And I saw that the article was trending, which meant that people were finally paying attention. And my next thought was, this is it. Because the spotlight doesn't come around very often on a particular organization, a particular issue, but it was on USAG and it was on the issue of sexual abuse. And I thought maybe the Indy Star can get the truth out about Larry too.
So Larry Nassar, moving the story on a little bit, Rachel, in the sense that Larry Nassar was taken in for questioning, and there's audio of that, which I've heard of him trying to schmooze the police officers and trying to be, very defensive and saying, no, look at my YouTube clips, this is what I do, this is not off the wall, the girls are confused, and, just putting it back in there, he's articulate, he's charismatic, and he's everything that you would think your parents would trust, ultimately. But in some ways, he forgot to take the garbage out, as you'd say in America, and it was the garbage that really was an essential link in the chain to get him.
It was in terms of changing the public opinion.
Yes.
So when I saw the Indy Star report, I immediately contacted Indy Star and told them what had happened and that I would come forward as publicly as necessary if they could get the truth out. And I realized, I went back and researched the law and saw that I could still file a police report. And so at the same time I came forward publicly with the Indy Star, I filed a police report with the Michigan State University Police Department and started that investigation running, and also started an internal investigation running with the university in addition to this police report. And so all of that kind of started happening at once. And when the Indy Star published my story, other women started coming forward who identified being abused in Larry's home. He had a treatment table in his home that he would use to abuse children. And that allowed the police to get a search warrant for his home and to find the child porn. But it was several months down the road before they were able to announce that they had found the child porn. And so the public response to myself, and then eventually to some of the other women who came forward anonymously, was very vitriolic. It was everything I expected it to be.
Vitriolic against you.
Absolutely. I experienced what every sexual assault survivor experiences when they come forward. Oh, she's just in it for attention. She wants money. She wants to ruin a good man. And those are the same things every sexual assault victim hears when they dare to speak up. And I heard those things. And even once the child porn was found, there was actually still a significant number of people who refused to believe that Larry could be an abuser. There were people who suggested that the child porn had been planted in Larry's garbage cans. And so while it did eventually lead to a conviction for child porn, and it helped increase his sentence. A couple of years later, he was convicted and pled guilty, actually, to the possession of child porn, and then was charged with and ultimately pled guilty to sexual abuse, sexually abusing me and sexually abusing a number of other women.
Of course, you stood up, Rachel, and you said enough with that article we talked about from the Indy Star. And you were subjected to vile abuse from people who said you're making it up, etc. And you also found, you probably lost friends and along the way, and people gathered around the beast in some ways, Larry Nassar, and said, no, this guy couldn't have done this. We know him. This woman is wrong. Tell me, how many women ultimately came forward to accuse Larry Nassar of abusing them?
By the time we got to the sentencing hearing, the first sentencing hearing in Ingham County, there were 156 women that spoke in Ingham County. And then there were another 60 or so that spoke in Eaton County, another jurisdiction where he was charged with abuse. To date, over 500 women have now come forward as victims of Larry's abuse. I think that is scratching the surface, because what we now know is that he was abusing children every day, all day long, and he had unlimited access to children for literally 40 years. And the other thing that we found out during this process is that I was right. Girls had been reporting Larry's abuse for years. He had actually been reported to 3 different police departments by the time they came forward. All of them had cleared him. The FBI here in the United States had sat on reports against Larry for more than a year. We discovered that the earliest reports went back to 1997, years before I walked in Larry's door, and before most of the victims were abused. Most of us could have been saved had the adults in authority done the right thing when those first reports of abuse came out in 1997.
It is absolutely not only terrifying, but horrific, sense of collaboration between state forces and one man against all these innocent children and young women. It's extraordinary. And, you know, there are echoes in this country down through the years of that kind of thing. And I suspect there's a lot of people listening in today, Rachel, saying she's telling our story in a manner of speaking. But they just feel, and this is the point that you make in your book, and this is the point, this is why you wrote a children's book as well as an adult's book, is that victims should never feel shame. It has to be reflected the other way entirely.
That's absolutely right. You know, the shame for what happened, the guilt for what happened, that falls on the abuser and to a certain degree on the enablers who did not act, who did not listen to survivors, who spoke up, who ignored warning signs, who were in a position to do something and didn't. But far too often that's placed on the victims.
I recall watching on the news from America the case, the court case, and the string of young women, all, you know, gymnasts and mostly, and including yourself, and you were delivering victim impact statements, and it was amongst the most powerful things I've ever seen on television, particularly in the realm of news, because it was so raw and so honest. And I wonder, would it be okay with you if I played some moments of your victim impact statement? Are you okay if I play a bit of that now?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sure, okay, thank you. This is Rachel, our guest, Rachel Den Hollander, face to face with Larry Nassar in the courtroom.
How much is a little girl worth? How much is a young woman worth? Larry is a hardened and determined sexual predator. I know this firsthand. At age 15, when I suffered from chronic back pain, Larry sexually assaulted me repeatedly under the guise of medical treatment for nearly a year. He did this with my own mother in the room, carefully and perfectly obstructing her view so that she would not know what he was doing. His ability to gain my trust and the trust of my parents, his grooming and carefully calculated brazen sexual assault, was the result of deliberate, premeditated, intentional, and methodological patterns of abuse, patterns that were rehearsed long before I walked through Larry's exam room door, and which continued to be perpetrated, I believe, on a daily basis for 16 more years. Until I filed the police report.
Rachel, what was it like looking at him, at that man, and delivering that victim impact statement?
It was in some ways, a surreal experience. It was not the first time I had faced Larry in court. By the time we got to the impact statement, I had already been through testifying in open court in what we call a preliminary examination. So I testified under oath with Larry in the room for almost 3 hours already, just to get to that point, to get to the point where he pled guilty and we could give our impact statements. So it wasn't the first time I had seen him in court. But I think one of the things that that the survivors of Larry's abuse were given, and it was a gift that most survivors don't ever get, is we were given recognition and we were given a voice. You know, we were given validation. The justice system was used to bring justice, not just on our abuser, but to validate what we had been through. And I think one of the things we need to wrestle with culturally is how broad the issue of justice really is, and that justice is intended to be restorative. And when you have been through sexual abuse, through an experience that robs you of your dignity and your personhood and your voice, part of that restoration is being given that voice back, being given the opportunity to tell the truth about what happened to you and to face your abuser. And we were given that opportunity, but most sexual abuse victims aren't. And so that was something that, honestly, I actually felt very keenly was, you know, what a gift it was to be given our voices back. And I felt the weight of the fact that most victims around the world are never going to get that gift. And living with that question of what do we need to change so that our halls of justice, our courts of justice, really become a place of justice, that we can hold abusers accountable for what they have done, and we can restore the personhood and the dignity and the voice to survivors.
Beautifully put. Life for you now, Rachel, you're married to Jacob. You have how many children?
We have four, a boy and three daughters. They are lovely, delightful, sometimes disobedient, wonderful children.
And how are you? I know obviously in the middle of all of this, you've had to confront it, come to terms with it. You've been extraordinary and you continue to advocate as an attorney and as a mother and as a victim. How have you come out the other side, if I could put it that way?
You know, that's something I've really had to wrestle with, is the reality that healing doesn't mean you become who you were before you were abused. The permanency of the damage of abuse, the wounds and the scars that are always there. Again, I think that's something we don't wrestle with enough societally. We want it to be neat and clean, where if you get the right counseling and you do the right things and maybe you get your day in court, you become fully healed, and you get to tie your life up with this neat little bow in this pretty little package, and everything's good. But that's not the reality. Sexual abuse is devastating, and there are wounds and scars that I will carry for the rest of my life. I don't like that. I would like that to not be the case, but that is. That's the reality. That being said, I am grateful for the healing and the hope that I've been able to find. I am grateful for the gift that we were given in being able to confront our abuser. But I really did have to get to a place long before filing a police report against Larry that I realized that my value and my identity and my ability to heal from abuse wasn't dependent on the societal response that I received.
For how long was Larry Nassar sentenced to prison?
He was sentenced to 175 years in my case, 60 years for the possession of child porn, and I believe it's 125 for the crimes in Eaton County. So he has received a life sentence. He will never be getting out of jail. He will never be able to harm a child again.
Rachel, thank you so much for your time today. Your book is, I think, an important book. I think a book that'll resonate with so many people in this country. Your bravery is astonishing, and I hope life is kinder to you as an adult than it was as a child. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Rachel Den Hollander joining us today. Her books, there are two of them actually, the adult books. The first book is What is a Girl Worth? As per the opening question she asked her abuser in court there in the victim impact statement you just heard. And the other is for children. It's called How Much is a Little Girl Worth? And I think that, again, there are two books for very different reasons that will have a place in the bookshops of Ireland in the next month or so. It's important to say, obviously, after an interview like that, that if you've been affected by any of the issues discussed with Rachel, there is help. And I always say that the help, I'm not just reading these numbers for no reason. They're there, please, for a reason. If you are thinking, I've always wanted to talk about it. I've always needed to talk about it. You could be 70, you could be 50, you could be 15. Make the call. The Dublin Rape Crisis Centre is on 1800 77 88 88 or drcc.ie. And of course, 1 in 4, always there. Dublin number 01662 4070 or 1in4.ie. Make the call, go online, make the difference, and hopefully life will be kinder to you. The text number 51551.